this is work done in collaboration with James Bullock and Apoorv Stuttgart-Stugari and a student. Okay, so I basically want to give you a one slide review of dark matter properties, the kinds of properties that I'm going to be using. So there's three things that are important for what I'll talk about. One is really, if you think about the dark matter in the early universe, at some point it was in contact with the Standard Model. And so during that time, there's a mean free path for the dark matter. And in cosmology, we typically call it damping length. Once the dark matter decouples from the Standard Model, it can still move before it falls into some sort of a potential well, like a halo. And we call that a free streaming length. And the third interesting thing is the phase space density. So just in one way of thinking about it is, what is the temperature of dark matter for a given density? Okay. And the nice thing about, you can think about this phase space density as this Q parameter. It's an average. It doesn't really determine all the properties, but it's a nice thing to keep in mind. And after freeze out, which means after the dark matter stops interacting with the Standard Model, it's a constant. And essentially, it tells you something about the temperature for a fixed density. So the smaller the temperature, the colder the particle, the larger the phase space density. Okay. So keep in mind these three properties that come up for any given model that you write down for dark matter. You can calculate these things. Okay. And nice thing about this is the mass density set by the annihilation cross sections, whereas the temperature or the root mean square velocity is set by the scattering interactions for the dark matter off of the Standard Model particle. So what does it do? Again, I'll tell you in two slides what it does at the end of the day in cosmology. So this slide is about the free streaming and the damping, the first two properties. And what it does is it suppresses power. So here is the amplitude of fluctuations. So if I look at density fluctuations in the universe and I plot that as a function of scale, so this is scale, small scales on this side, large scales on that side. Essentially, what happens is, so the black line there is for the damping. The damping introduces, it's what it is. It's basically damped oscillations. And the power spectrum goes to zero. Okay. And the free streaming scale does the same thing. It wipes out fluctuations on small scales. And so in effect, both those things are doing the same thing. It's just wiping out power on really small scales out here. And again, this is something you can calculate for any given model where you have dark matter. You can actually calculate these things. Okay. And this is in linear theory, so we've not yet formed any galaxies. This is still very early in the universe. What happens in the nonlinear theory? So nonlinear theory just means that the dark matter actually ends up forming halos in which galaxies form. Rather than show you anything numerical, I just thought I would give you an idea. So here's the number of halos as a function of mass. So this is how many halos do you get in a particular of a particular mass. And essentially what happens is, if you look at just the Standard Models, the number of halos keeps rising on to small masses and eventually will turn over at some minimum mass. This minimum mass is going to be set by your damping length and your free streaming length, okay? So this is the nonlinear effect of the first two properties I talked about. So for a given damping and free streaming length, there's no halos below a certain minimum mass. Exactly how this is related to that is not easy. You have to do numerical simulations, and people have. Okay, so there were three properties I talked about. The first two I just gave you, sort of the brief picture of what it does in the late universe. Here's what it does. Here's what the third property does. This is from a simulation by Diemand et al. It's a simulation of a halo that could host the Milky Way, so our own galaxy. There's no baryons in here. It's all dark matter. And the scale is just density, the brightness. So and you can clearly see that there's a lot of substructure, small halos. Okay, so that's the main part of the galaxy. Our disk would lie here in the center, innermost regions. Okay, and there's a whole bunch of smaller halos around it. This phase space that I'm talking about, the way I like to think about it is it actually changes this picture in two ways. If I pick any particular halo here, even this one, or let's say I go here and I pick a small halo, okay? And I look inside it, I can see how the density changes as a function of radius. If I go from the center outside, I can see how the density is changing. And what the phase space density, what this Q parameter does is, it tells you how far in you can go and keep increasing the density. Eventually, the density will have to turn off. It'll have to stop rising. And the place where that happens, sort of the core, is set by this Q. Okay? And again, this is a very nonlinear effect, and you have to do simulations. I can very rigorously tell you what the minimum scale radius should be, but I can't really tell you for a given mass, for a given halo, what the real radius is. I can just tell you it has to be larger than something. Okay? So for actually figuring out what it is, you have to go again and do a numerical simulation. There's a second effect, which is not looking inside the halos, but just counting up these things. Okay? It's the same, similar plot to what I had last time, but slightly different. Instead of just counting up all the halos, I'm saying, let me count up all the halos inside this big halo. Okay, this is a halo which would be about 100 kiloparsecs or so, okay, 300 light years. Let me count up all the halos inside and make a plot of the number of subhalos. So these things are called subhalos because they are in a bigger, virialized halo as a function of mass. And this m, this phase space density, essentially what it does is if you make the density flat here, then these halos as they fall in, some of them get completely stripped. These are the ones that survive. The flatter you make this, the easier you get stripped, okay? So it does a similar thing. It actually turns this curve over. And again, there's this M cut, which is related to the phase space density. And it doesn't necessarily have to be equal to the M min I defined in the previous slide. You have to do simulations to get these, okay? So three properties of dark matter in terms of cosmology to keep in mind that you can relate to any given beyond standard model. So here's, for example, I'm just putting different models, like you had a stellar neutrino or a standard WIMP, where they would lie on these things. It's very hard. In fact, I have no way of actually distinguishing between these two axes. But between that and this axis, you can, because of the different effects. Okay. And turns out, typically, this axis here is related to one of these in most models. Like if you have a sterile neutrino, the only thing there is the mass of the neutrino. If you give me the mass of the neutrino, I can tell you what its phase space density is in the early universe. I can tell you what the free streaming scale is. Everything is fixed. You break that relation if you make models where, for example, you have decays, where the dark matter comes from decays. But in general, most of the models, there is a relation between them, okay? And just as a technical point, this Q doesn't really determine everything. You have to really look at the primordial momentum distribution. Okay, so that was just the three effects. So in terms of theories, in standard supersymmetric theories, you get sort of theories where the dark matter is very cold, as well as dark matter that's really warm. So here's a neutralino being the LSP. In this case, the kinetic decoupling happens at around 10 to 100 MeV, maybe a couple of hundred MeV. And cold dark matter has very large phase space densities in these astronomical units. Forget what it is. Just remember that it's very large, 10 to the 14. Okay? And the minimum halo mass turns out to be around the Earth mass. But if I have a gravitino or an axino LSP, things are very different because the gravitino could be produced by the decay of an NLSP. Okay? And in this case, it turns out that these particles are warm, which means these phase space densities here, Q, could be of order 1 or even smaller. So 14 orders of magnitude smaller. And so that gives you some way of distinguishing between these two things, because these guys are going to be very hard. You know, if the star is, for example, very heavy, like 2 TeV, it's going to be very hard to see any time in the future in colliders. Okay? So this offers you a complementary way of looking at things, which is why the title had local dwarfs, because what I want to do is go back and just look at the observations of these dwarf galaxies. So you know, distinguishing these kinds of, like a gravitino dark LSP and a neutrino LSP, there's a whole bunch of things you can do, but I'm just going to look at the small scale structure formation. So just to keep in mind, here's what I'm talking about. One of the things we talked about is the suppression and power spectrum. The place where it really comes in for these models is in the satellites of the Milky Way, which means those small sub-halos that you saw in that picture, on those scales. That's where the power to distinguish them comes in. So here's a picture of the local group. The local group is typically defined as both us, the Milky Way, and the Andromeda, and all the stuff in the middle. Okay, so this is 700-800 KPC. And the Andromeda has a whole bunch of small galaxies around it. The Milky Way has a whole bunch of small galaxies around it. And some of these are labeled. This picture has changed dramatically in the last 4 years with a survey of about 20% of the sky. And we've doubled the number of these small galaxies we know of. Okay? So you want to think of these small satellites as living inside those subhalos. Pick the biggest subhalos in that simulation I showed you and put some baryons in there. And that's where they should be. So you can try to map what you see to what you simulate. So here, this is a busy plot, but it's a really neat plot. What's plotted here is the luminosity, so how bright some objects are as a function of the size of the objects. So I'm looking at small objects and plotting this. These things here are called globular clusters, so they're just bunches of stars. They could be like a million stars or typically 10,000 stars, 100,000 stars. And they are in our galaxy and have very little dark matter. All it is just stars. These guys are the are the dwarf galaxies, the satellite galaxies, which were known for a long time, for 100 years. And in the last 4 years, these are the new ones that have been found. And the reason is people are going down. This is surface brightness. So as your survey gets better and better, you go down this way. And you found all of these new galaxies. Okay, and they'll find more. They will. I mean, they'll be like, 20, 30, 40, maybe a couple of hundred more discovered. And so you can start thinking about what it does to, constraining supersymmetric parameter spaces. And the amazing thing is the luminosity spans over 4 orders of magnitude in here. It goes from 1,000 suns to about 10 million solar luminosities. So, it's even weird to call this a galaxy. It's got just 1,000 stars. But they are completely dominated by dark matter. So let me skip this. So I think that these things, in some sense, these dwarf galaxies are the best objects to test this paradigm of whether the dark matter is cold, whether it's a WIMP, for a few reasons. One is you can look for products of self-annihilation or decay of dark matter. So if dark matter is a neutralino, then in the center of those halos, you expect them to annihilate and produce gamma rays and from secondary processes produce X-rays. And so you could look at these guys with GLASP, which is going to go up this week, hopefully, and a bunch of other experiments. And the nice thing about these dwarfs are they're close and they're dark matter dominated, as I'll show in the next slide. They have low intrinsic backgrounds because, it's 1,000 stars, maybe 10,000, maybe 100,000, but very little star formation. So there is no real intrinsic. There will be eventually when you get down to observing them really well, but right now it looks like there's very little intrinsic background. And as I'll show in a couple of slides, there's a very good chance that we'll understand their spatial mass profile. So we'll know how the dark matter inside these guys is distributed, which would be really great. Okay. So you can measure their density profiles, and you can have a census of the dwarfs, count up the number. So at the present stage, it's very hard to figure out, right now at least, it's going to be very hard to know exactly how the density scales, how the density falls off with radius inside those halos. But one of the things you can do very well is measure a mass. And this is a measurement of the mass of, I don't know how many there are here, 15 or so of these guys. There's about 23 known satellites, of 15 of them. And for a lot of them, we measure the mass well. This is not the total mass. It's the mass within a radius of about 300 parsecs. And we chose 300 because that's where the mass was best measured. That's sort of the average stellar extent of these guys. Okay. So we have begun to know something about them. We can at least measure their masses really well. Okay. And this is interesting because now I can, since they are all dark matter dominated, I can take that same mass and go to a simulation and ask, how many of these guys are there in the simulation with these masses? And I can make predictions, and people have been doing this. I can make predictions for what their gamma ray luminosity should be if there are annihilations. So here's the interesting thing. There's four galaxies. So what I've plotted here is the flux of gamma rays from self-annihilations of, of, let's say, neutralino dark matter, and the likelihood of that happening based on all the data we have for a fixed SUSY model. And this, these three guys, this solid line, this dashed blue and a dashed green, red line, are three new satellites, and they have very small stellar luminosity, like 1,000. This green one is an old one. Okay, it's got a million stars in it. But they have almost the same amount of dark matter, and because these guys are closer, just turns out that you would expect a larger flux from these guys. Okay, in gamma ray annihilation. So they turn out to be really good candidates to look for these gamma ray annihilations from, right? I mean, the error bars are really big here still. The spread is pretty big. But that'll go down with more measurements. Okay, so they make ideal candidates to like look for these indirect signals. And here's a plot of a scan in constrained MSSM space. We got, this is in collaboration, so we got the, so this is what is being plotted here is the flux, and just for, just to see where we stand with the direct detection, what I'm plotting on the x-axis here is the spin-independent cross-section. So this is the larger of the proton or the neutron cross-section. And this line here is the limit that GLASS can get to. It's a rough limit with 4 or 5 years of data. Okay, so at least in this constrained MSSM parameter space, there's a reasonable chance that from one of these new guys, so this is Willman 1, one of the new really faint dwarf, that we'll be able to like actually make some headway. Okay. And just for the dark matter direct detection talk today, you see that you know people have gotten to around 10 to the minus 43 here, to the edge of this parameter space. So it's going to be very interesting as you know people sort of get constraints in this direction and also that. Okay. So before I end, I wanted to put up this plot, which I find very intriguing, and we have no explanation for. I'm not sure how this relates exactly to the nature of dark matter, and I'm not going to say that this is inconsistent with neutralino dark matter or anything like that. But what's plotted here is again the mass within 300 parsecs as a function of the luminosity. Okay, so this is the stellar luminosity, and you note that there's 18 of the 23 known satellites of the Milky Way are in here, and you know that the luminosity ranges from 1,000 to 10 million. But their masses, well, actually, statistically, they're pretty much consistent with being constant mass. Okay, there's some spread here just because the measurements are not very good. But they're all consistent with having the same mass, 10 to the 7 solar mass. And so, you know, the first striking thing is probably like, you know, why do they all have the same mass? But for me, the more striking is just like, you know, given some mass, why do they have such a huge spread in luminosity? Okay, what's the process that does it? And there's no clear-cut answer to this. And this may have implications for like just, you know, maybe you can't do this in CDM, or maybe you can only do this in CDM and not in, you know, not in let's say like a gravitino warm dark matter scenario. So this could really have implications for the nature of dark matter. So I'll take questions. Thanks.
Can you just go back one slide? I didn't get the point. I mean, why are you plot? Why does it depend on the scattering cross section?
No, it doesn't depend. This is just a whole a scan, and I was just making a two-dimensional plot of flux versus, because I wanted to see for myself just how far people are getting from this direction. So this is just a scan of the MSSM, CMSSM plus all the dwarf halo properties in there.